You're listening to The Real Short Box, a comic book podcast made for geeks by geeks.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in and listening to The Real Short Box. My name is Donald.
And I'm Chris.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. Sorry, I just snuck up on you. I'm Chris.
Yeah. Yeah, you did. You frightened me just a little bit. Just a little. My heart went beep, 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 beep really fast. We are here today to talk about, I don't know if you guys know this, but I created a web series back in the day called The Blue Beetle Ted Kord Returns.
There's supposed to be like a bell or something that rings every time you mention that.
It probably should be. Or at least somebody donates a dollar every time I say it, because we'd have a lot of dollars and that would be great. Then we could actually film the Christmas episode like I've wanted to do for forever. But that's what we're going to be talking about today is a little bit of Blue Beetle action. We're going to be talking about primarily just Chris and I are going to reminisce about the Blue Beetle Ted Kord Returns web series. Now, if I recall, we started filming this in 2012. Does that sound right?
No, 2011, I believe.
Was it 2011?
Because I moved out of California in 2012.
Maybe it was 2010, because 2010 hits me as the right number.
Yeah. So that could be right. I mean, we shot, what, two seasons with the two of us?
Yep, yeah.
And four seasons, and I think season three came out in 2012, so 2010 sounds right.
Yeah, that makes sense, because I don't think I put it on IMDb until later, because we were a SAG-authorized web series that was filming in Los Angeles, which is surprising that you can make that happen. But you can. It can happen. And you were very instrumental in that part, actually, because you had filmed something with SAG as well. You filmed a web series, and if I recall, it was called Girl Repellent.
Oh, that's correct. Yes. Because of that, you could be... Those of you who don't know, in Hollywood, SAG means the Screen Actors Guild, and there's certain contracts where like you can't do a movie or anything like that if you're SAG without paying the actors. However, there's one exception where the contract goes. I don't know if it's still this way to this day, but back in the day, you could do a new media contract with SAG, and you can. Basically, the actors can negotiate their own wages, as opposed to in movies, it had to be a minimum that had to be paid every single day that they're on set for a certain amount of hours. And if you go over 8 hours, you're going to pay overtime. But with new media contract, you could charge the actors got to they have to make their own negotiations for prices. And so you were able to, you know, affordably get actors to do these web series with SAG. Because they're able to negotiate their own prices, you had to pay, you know, $800 a day for someone with over five lines, which is what the going rate is for a SAG actor with an under five, which would be five lines or less. Mm-hmm. Well, I think if you do low budget, it's a little bit. I think it's 150 or something like that. But still,
yeah.
You know, having so, but you'd have to have everybody in the cast,
right? Basically. SAG. Somebody like us, you know, that was filming this, you know, we were starting out kind of getting our feet wet with productions and stuff. And we were on a micro budget, which means zero to low, very low budget. You couldn't afford the SAG basic actor pay per day. So we did this new media and it allowed us to defer payment if by some miracle, our web series would get picked up and become a television series or something else. You know, somebody paid for our ideas or whatever, then we would have funding and be able to pay said actors and people behind. Now, that was just for the actors, though. For production and crew, that was negotiated between us and the production and crew. And we always... we never could afford a lot, but we always could afford something to pay crew and in production crew. So that was always something that we made sure that we could do. Now, when it came to producing this, I believe the first season of the Blue Beetle was that one was executive produced by moi and Mr. Visa, because we really had no donations for the first season except for time. People would donate time that believed in the project, and the actors understood that it was something that was just starting out. And I will say the first season is rough, comparatively speaking, to all the others.
Especially the editing.
Yeah, the editing. The editing's fine. I have no problem with the editing at all. It's the camera work was a little rough. We had a gentleman that worked with us that he had a camera, but we didn't know the experience level. And sometimes people can talk up their experience levels, and we misinterpreted what that meant, and we went with that person. And primarily because that person also was extremely reasonable because they wanted to cut their teeth on something like this.
Yeah. So I think we also shot the whole thing without a sound person. We were kind of just setting up a recorder and a microphone and hoping it caught the sound.
No, actually we had gotten a Zoom. For those that don't know, a Zoom is a recording device that you hook up to a microphone and then it records, it captures the sound for you. And it's supposed to be a more clear, crisp type of sound in the hands of a professional. But we were handing it off to people, you know, that were production assistants or girlfriends or friends of friends, anybody that was available that had an extra hand to just hold it. We were handing it off, and it would get really good in some parts, and then it would not be as good in other parts. And after we got through the entire season of filming and everything, and you were in the editing bay, basically putting it all together, we were looking at that and going, oh man, this was not a great idea. So learning curve here, second season, we said, we have to pay somebody. We have to get a sound guy in. You had worked with a sound guy named Kevin before.
Yeah. With Girl Repellent. Was it Girl Repellent or it was Romeo and Juliet?
I think it was Romeo and Juliet, if I recall.
Yes. Yeah.
And I liked him and the way he worked. So I didn't poach him. That's a weird terminology, but I asked you for his information. You said, yeah, sure. And then I reached out to him and I said, hey man, I plan on doing multiple seasons of this. Would you want to be a part of this? And he was like, yeah, sure. You know, so we agreed to terms on price. And I'll tell you what, that man was a trooper, Kevin.
Didn't we end up getting our camera guy through Romeo and Juliet as well?
Yeah, we got the camera guy through Thomas.
Yeah.
Through Thomas Hennessy through Romeo and Juliet as well. Him and I worked behind the camera. Oftentimes I was assisting him. And a few points in time, he would have to leave and I would cover for him. And we, you know, just to get these shots done. And it worked out really well. And we had a good rapport and we worked really well together. So I said to him, I said, hey, can you do this? I can't pay you a lot. And he said, don't worry about it. I don't want payment. I want to practice. I want to get better. But just make me a producer on the series. And if you have any roles that need filled, I'd be happy to step in for them.
So all you future filmmakers out there listening to this podcast right now, your best friend for paying people for actors is offer them to be, if they're trying to get into SAG, offer them to be in a SAG web series and they automatically become eligible to join SAG. It's a lot harder to do that if you can't. So that's a good way for, and then for crew people, offer a producer credit. They love it.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that's the only way to go about it, because sometimes, you know, money talks, I get that. But if you're just starting out, this is usually the best way that you could do it and without insulting somebody. You don't want to ever tell somebody that's an artist, for example, oh, do it for exposure. Artists hate that. That is not something you say to them. You say, I want to work with you later down the line, and I want to be able to pay you, but I can't right now. If you want to work with me on this, we can work together. And that's what actually happened with me and the cartoon artist that did the comic book panels, Louis Castillo. He did those comic book panels for us, and he was wonderful. We met him at a comic book convention, actually. And me and Kevin, a.k.a. Black Licorice, Those that don't know, Chris played Dr. Hypnover, and I played
Hypnovac.
Yes. So we were able to then eventually pay him for these panels as we progressed along. But at first, we just didn't have it in the budget. Once we got season one done and people saw that we could finish a season, they were interested in then possibly investing into a season two. So we started to get a little money trickling in for season two. By season three, we were almost completely fully funded, which was great because you could definitely see as we went along the production value increase from the end of season two. If you look back on the end of season two, comparatively with the beginning of season one, it is night and day.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say to this day that I think the final episode of season two is the best shot episode of the whole series.
I can't really argue that because I think it is really well done as far as from a cinematic standpoint, from a cinematographer's standpoint. I think Thomas and Marian did a hell of a job. I think they did Marian Franzen and Thomas Hennessy did just a terrific job with the filming of it.
Yeah, and, while shooting in 110 degree desert.
Yeah, I mean, I passed out basically, almost passed out. I got heat exhaustion. And we had to shut down production because I remember I had to use my battle suit, which is this one that if it got tore up, it wouldn't matter. I had to have multiple costumes for the Blue Beetle. And the battle suit one had double thick lining on the head. So it was like wearing a beanie in 110, 113 degree heat in a desert with no shade. So, yeah, it got me fast.
We were all pretty sick. Like, I mean, I was wearing an all-black suit.
You know? Yeah, you were. You were wearing a whole suit with a big bowler hat, black bowler hat and stuff.
All black, yeah. We were all dying.
Yeah.
And death's door in that episode. And it still looks fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. So those that are wondering, you go to YouTube, you type in The Blue Beetle Ted Kord Returns. I believe it's episode 7 of season 2. We had 7 episode seasons. Season 1, I believe, was 7. Season 2 was 7. Season 3 was 7. And season 4 was just 4 episodes, primarily because of we didn't want to extend season 3. And we had to, for reasons be out of my anything that I could do, I couldn't foresee the reason behind having to put a pause in it, but we had to delay season 4, and season 4 got delayed by a couple years. We had most of the footage shot, but we still needed some pickup shots, and those just became increasingly hard to do as some of the talent started to move away, and we had to figure out creative ways to bring that talent back in. Even some of it, like, for example, my friend Ashley Williams, who he's an Australian comedian and actor. I met him in L.A. on a set with Thomas, actually. Thomas was shooting a short, and he knew Ash, and he had Ash come in for it. And him and I got along like gangbusters, Ash and I. And so I had him come and be the Spectre for season 3 of the series. We shot out of a comic shop, and it just looked beautiful, by the way. He's a perfect Spectre. I mean, he did a wonderful job. He moved back to Australia, so I obviously couldn't bring him. I financially, yes, I'd want to fly him out and have him, you know, do his scenes and stuff, but everything that we could do in comic panel form and just have him do the audio. Well, even that was hard at times, so eventually I had to step in, do the audio, and then have that tweaked a little bit to sound more like him. So in some parts, when there's some just audio of the Spectre, that's me. And the same way with some of the other roles too, I had to step in and do the voice of some of the other characters, which is fun, but also, you know, kind of disappointing for me because I wanted to get the original actor, the original talent to be able to do it, to fulfill that whole thing. But it is what it is. And this is another thing that as a producer, writer, director, you have to look at and you have to think about.
Yeah, I mean, you also lost, you know, you lost me as well, which I'm sure made it harder for you having to rewrite a lot of stuff, knowing that, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Basically, the assistant's gone.
basically you leaving Chris as Dr. Hypnovert, which is an original character that we created and put out in comic form on our website before we integrated it into the Blue Beetle universe. And we did that because we wanted to have exclusive rights to that character. So DC couldn't say, hey, you did this fan film of our comic books and you put new characters in it. Well, guess what? Those characters are ours now. We didn't want that. I don't know if they could do that. I have no idea. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know any of that. So to guard myself and the talent and the creation, I said, hey, let's put this in comic book form first, in comic panel form, and put it up on the website. So it was released there first. It is a Rumble Spoon Productions property. And then we can integrate it into the Blue Beetle world, which is what we did with Dr. Hypnovert. It's what we did with Kevin Green's character, Black Licorice. It's what we did with Marie Saint's character, the Scarlet Beetle, and so on and so forth. So it became that way. So yeah, when Chris left, he had to leave after season two. So Chris left for New York. And when Chris did that, it did create a bit of a juggling issue for, oh no, what do we do? We wrote you out of season at the end of season two, beginning of season three. In season three, I actually, in cartoon comic book form, dropped you off at the airport and you took off and you went to New York because at the end of season two, Chris's character said, I think I'm going to leave, go for on a vacation or something. Maybe I'll go to New York.
And yeah, so somewhere out there, there is a missing episode with him in New York doing stuff. Somewhere in the world.
Somewhere in the world. Hopefully someday finished, but for now, that's what it is. So Hypnovert went on his own. Now, we had to say, well, what do we do? So I thought, well, we basically created Laurel and Hardy again with the Blue Beetle and Dr. Hypnovert. So I said, let's do Abbott and Costello with the Blue Beetle and Dr. Hypnovert, but we'll flip it. Instead of me being a little bit silly and you being the more serious one at times, I became the more serious one, and we brought in Booster Gold, Ron Carlson, who plays Booster Gold in the series, to be the more silly one, to be the Costello to my Abbott. And it worked. It ended up working really well. Ron did an amazing job playing Booster Gold and stepped into the role, and it really filled that gap that was created when you left the series. So season three picks up, you're being flown off to the to New York to go stay or visit or whatever you're going to do. You're just gone after that. And then I come back from the airport, and there's a guy there in a chair waiting in the shadows, and he's like, who are you? And it's Booster, and he found out that Blue Beetle's back, and he's wondering how. Because originally, this series was created because in 2000, I think it was 2005 or 2006, maybe 2008. I think it was probably 2008. I'm terrible with dates, guys. And you'll learn this as you listen to more podcasts from us. But I do my best. They killed off Geoff Johns in the DC Comics world, killed off Ted Kord. Maxwell Lord shot him in the head. And we mentioned that at the beginning of season one in the pilot. And it's all about how did Ted Kord come back and why? And it basically, we learned that he came back because of Max Lord. So Max Lord shot him, but Max Lord also brought him back to life. And he did not mean to do that. It was an accident. He was trying to unlock the power of the Scarab. Which is a kind of of course, it's a beetle-shaped amulet that gave the original Blue Beetle, Dan Garrett, and this is a comic book character from the 40s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and even 60s to a certain degree, who was created that had this Scarab amulet that could bring him great power. Well, Ted Kord, which is a character I played, who took over the mantle, never could unlock that power. So it's basically like the Transformers when Optimus Prime hands it's not called the Allspark in the cartoon. It's called the Matrix, I believe. Hands it over to the other guy. What was the other Transformer, the leader? it wasn't Optimus Prime. It was Ultra Magnus or something like that.
In the cartoon?
Yeah, in the movie.
Yeah, I asked the wrong person. I never watched the cartoon.
Okay, so Ultra Magnus, I think, is who it was. And he couldn't unlock the power of the Matrix. Same thing. Ted Kord couldn't unlock the power. So Maxwell Lord had to use the dead body of Dan Garrett in order to try to unlock the power. And when he did that, it brought me back to life. It brought Ted Kord back to life. And it brought Dan Garrett back to life. And Max was like, oh, shit. And then he couldn't. Then the Scarab got lost for a while. It kind of escaped and went on its own. And, you know, it goes on into the story of how the Scarab gets into Ted Kord's hands again. And what Max was trying to do. And then later on, it brings in Eclipso. And we learned that Eclipso played a part in all of this. And Eclipso is basically the wrath of God, the original wrath of God. And he was kicked out because he was too violent and he wanted to basically become God. God saw that and kicked him out and brought in the Spectre, who replaced God, or not God, who replaced, sorry, Eclipso, and was the new wrath of God. So Eclipso's always been kind of jealous about that and always wanted to take back that power. And he sees the Scarab as being part of that power as well. So it gets, it's not as complicated as it sounds. It's literally 25 episodes, if I recall, this whole series. It can be watched in about an hour and a half to 2 hours, and you're done, and you've watched the entire thing. That is a smaller investment than you would get in a DC comic book film, for sure. Marvel event movie.
Yeah, because you got to remember, those of you listening, we shot this in a time where web series weren't, Netflix really wasn't doing a lot of original content yet. It was still DVDs and Disney Plus, all these other streaming services didn't exist. So web series was literally taking like episodes of a TV show and splitting it in the chunks.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have basically 3.5 episodes of a TV show, of a half hour TV show, split over 4 seasons. You know, that's how they did it back in the day. To help, you know, viewers, and just for money purposes. You couldn't afford to just go in and shoot a full half hour episode every day, especially when you didn't know if one person was going to watch it or not. So it'd be like going and spending like $12 million on like on one episode of a TV series for something
when you don't have the money. Yeah, and you've borrowed the money from everybody, yeah.
Without HBO backing you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that would have been a big mistake. So it's not something that's easy to do. It's easier now, I think, to create a web series and create content and stuff through the onset of more sophisticated phones, like your iPhone. You could film an entire film on an iPhone, and it will work very well. You didn't really have that back in the day. As far as like when we first started, like back in 2010, we didn't really have that. So we weren't able to come up with that type of quality that we wanted, but we were happy with our results nonetheless. And I think, again, if you look, each season got better and better as far as writing and quality. And at some point, I think it was season 3, I said, okay, I've written season 1 and 2, and it's good, but I need help to make it better. So I hired in a buddy of mine that happened to own a comic shop. His name is Michael Freeman, and he stepped in and actually directed a couple episodes of season 3 and even season 4, actually, and helped me write parts of season 3 and season 4 as well. So we really worked well together as a writing duo. And sadly, that was the last that we've written together. Michael moved, and that was the end of that. I don't know actually where he's at now in the world. But you'll find in LA, this happens a lot. You'll have somebody that you really click with and you work well with, and then the next thing you know, they have to leave. And that's the end of that. you know, with me and Chris, it was season one and two, and then season four, three and four, it was me and Michael that worked really well together. And Thomas too, of course, and Mariah and Kevin, we were all a really tight knit, good group of people that worked really well together. And so working on this was an honor and a privilege, I think. And I'd love to talk more about it at some point. We could even call this just part one of our Blue Beetle conversation, because I feel like there's going to be more that we'll have to discuss. And possibly we can bring Kevin in, who was Black Licorice for the series. We brought him in, I think, when did we bring him in? Season two, wasn't it?
It was season two, because we needed, because season one was all about you, about Blue Beetle kind of figuring out what happened to him, and then also getting the two of them, Blue Beetle and Hypnovert, kind of to team up.
Uh-huh.
We had to, you know, we had to introduce a villain that, you know, a villain and a hero could team up against. And then season two, we were able to introduce more. We were able to spread out into more of the DC verse, and be able to start introducing these other, you know, heroes that we're working with.
Yeah, we were, and we had in some interesting talent. Some people have moved on to do quite a lot of work. Thomas Hennessy does a lot of film work. He's a cinematographer. He's a camera op. He does a ton of productions. He works quite a bit. Paris Dillon, who was a waiter in episode two, has moved on to work with the likes of Andy Dick and others, and traveled with him and stuff. And we've had, I think it was Michael Ian Thomas, I want to say, or something like that, who I just watched in a stage production of your favorite Christmas film, Love Actually. So, you know, a lot of these people have moved on to such great things. It would be great to kind of go a little more in depth and talk about some of these individuals and some of their work that they've done prior and after, and just what we endured on set and stuff. This is only just a quick taste of it. But yeah, I feel like we can go a little bit further. But, you know, if only one person listens to this, then we probably won't go any further into it. But if people want to hear more in depth about the behind the scenes, the dirt and the grime and the gloss and the glitz of web production, you know, we're pretty much aficionados in that. We've done a lot in that world, and we're happy, definitely very happy to share that information. So again, thank you for listening to us here at the Real Short Box. My name is Donald.
And I'm Scary Chris.
Yeah, he's so scary. He's so scary. And with that, perhaps if we don't see you out and about anytime soon, we will see you
at the comic book shop.
This has been The Real Short Box. We'll see you at the comic shop. Thanks for listening.